What's up, OUXers? I am very excited to share with you this conversation with Abby Covert. We nerded out real hard, as you might imagine, talking about things like how it's not a very good situation when you're using 14 words to describe a video object, and how deciding when to go down the rabbit hole is actually a whole art. Do you go down the rabbit hole? Is it rabbit season? Is it not rabbit season? Do you dip a pinky toe in there? Is it actually sometimes the wrong time to go down that rabbit hole? And we are really good at seeing those rabbit holes, OUXers and information architects. Do you hear me? Yes. We are very good at going down those rabbit holes. And in many ways, the ORCA process encourages going down those rabbit holes. But this gives a lot of really important nuance, this conversation does, on when to go down those rabbit holes and when to not go down the rabbit holes. We also talk about things like how friend can be an object, a relationship, a verb. We basically talk a lot about words and language. And it was just a really, really delightful conversation. And I can't wait to get into it with you. Before we do, just quick announcement for you. If you are listening to this in somewhat real time, on May 16th, 2024, at 3 to 5-ish p.m. Eastern Standard Time, probably 6 p.m. if I'm going to be honest, I am running a training session called OUX for AI and AI for OUX. That was really hard to get out because I'm talking about IA right now, and I am quite dyslexic, actually. So if I ever mess, if you hear me mixing up IA and AI, please know that in general, I do know what I'm talking about, and I know the difference between those. My dyslexia is coming out real strong because it's two vowels, too. That's hard. Okay, so that is happening on May 16th, 2024. It is, you're going to get a whole lot of bang for your buck. You can go to meetup.com. Go to meetup.com/OUX Happy Hour. I'm to join UX Happy Hour. We'll put the link in the show notes to make sure that you can get there. But it's going to be a really interesting event. I am very, very excited about showing you all the ways that OUX beautifully applies to the design of artificial intelligence agents, artificially intelligent agents, bots, generative AI, all that good trendy stuff that is taking over our world right now. And it's here to stay. We can't put this genie back in the bottle. So strap in. So that's going to be a really fun event. I am in that rabbit hole. That is a rabbit hole that I am in for sure. And I am just really, really excited to share what I have been learning and the frameworks that I am starting to build, the frameworks that are emerging on how to design for this brave new world, and also how to use AI in our OUXing as well. So we're going to be looking at it from both sides of the coin, basically AI as a medium that we are designing in, and also AI as a tool for OUX. So we will look at it from both directions, and go ahead and check out the link in the show notes and make sure you are there. All right. I will see you in the episode. Enjoy. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Abby Covert, welcome to the OUX podcast.
Oh my gosh, Sophia, thank you so much for having me.
It's been a long time coming.
It has.
So I actually want to go and do our little go down memory lane again on our call yesterday with Alfie. It was really fun to kind of back up and be like, oh, how did we get here? Here today? So we met at a conference back in the beginning of 2015, and it was right before the IA summit of 2015. And we had lunch with this beautiful lunch. And basically our relationship started with you as a mentor to me. I remember you looked at all of my slides, like 200 slides for my very first big ticket OUX workshop, and helped me a lot with that right there in the beginning. And that's where it all started. And then we kind of just been like checking in on each other every now and then. And then last year, I went to your event, Make Sense Mess.
Yeah.
And which was amazing. And you had not one, but two OUXers on your speaking stage. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So shout out to Karen Huell and Anna Therese also.
Yep.
Was in the community as well. So that was really, really cool to see. And it was an amazing event. And actually, do you have a date for this year's event?
Yes, it is the first Friday of November, which I believe to be November 1st. And it's going to be a big one. It's the 10th anniversary of How to Make Sense of Any Mess. So,
okay, beautiful. Let's just distract ourselves from the election for a little bit on November 1st. Yeah. That'll be wonderful. So everybody mark your calendars. And if you've got a link for that, or when you get a link for that, let me know. And we'll make sure to get that out, because it's an amazing, affordable, like, one day, like almost a day event.
And 2 hours, honestly. It was two hours. Yeah.
Only 2 hours. I feel like I got so much out of it that, like, I was like, it must have been a full day. Mm-hmm. It filled a day in my heart. But it was really, really fun. And I was so glad to see some OUXers on the stage. That was really, really cool. And basically we've kind of like, you've been mentoring me, and now we're sort of like in this sort of co-conspiratorial place right here, where we have this kind of shared goal of democratizing information architecture. So it's more collaborative, more accessible to more people, getting UX designers to sort of embrace or re-embrace information architecture is really a vital part of their skill set to make transformative work. So Abby, I think most people that are listening know you, but you are the author of two amazing books, the classic Making Sense of Any Mess, which I've read like three times. If you haven't read it, definitely go read it. And then you have a newish book out, Stuck, about diagramming. And I've not read that one yet, but it is on the docket. I think we're going to be doing that next for our Books Club. Awesome. Books Club is within the forum for our masterclass folks. And I think we're going to be doing that one next. So very excited to be reading that this year. And like I said, you're the host of the Make Sense Mess event. What else do you have going on right now? What are you up to?
Yeah, right now I am really focusing on connecting all these readers that I've gathered over the last 10 years. I really had this thought that they all needed to meet each other, because I thought that they would really get along, and Make Sense Mess has proven that. I've had people definitely connecting from that event. I want to scale that up to be more than once a year. So that's really been my focus for the last year or so. I've been experimenting with like how big I could scale this by myself. And my next step is to see how I can scale it bigger than myself. So I have two things in the works. The first is a SenseMaker in Residence program. My first SenseMaker, Alfie Alo, I co-created a 12-week cohort-based class with him on making sense of yourself. So we just wrapped up cohort one, and we're filling up cohort two currently. And then we have another secret SenseMaker to be announced in April that will be joining us as the second resident. So my goal with that is to really broaden the topics, but also the offerings for the education part of the SenseMakers Club. And then on the community side, I've started to recruit discussion leaders, because I want to host a monthly discussion series. And when I say discussion, I really mean discussion, not like a lightning talk with a Q&A, but like people actually discussing a topic that they're prepared to discuss. I think there's a lot of value in that potentially for SenseMakers that really are doing that kind of work, but aren't necessarily connecting with other people on a peer level outside of their jobs. So exciting time.
Yeah. It's so important to get these nerds together, because sometimes it's hard to find, hard to find your people. So, I mean, building the community and being able to see, in my community, being able to see like OUXers getting each other jobs and like going on vacation together. Like I got to see that before, like sending me pictures from their vacation, or like just knowing that, like, you know, getting it started And then knowing that it's like, it's just happening without you is like one of the most beautiful things ever.
I
Like,
think that's how you know that it's community as opposed to, you know, just like a, I don't know, fan club, I guess. So
yeah.
I think there's a lot of thoughtful design work that goes into that. Cause I think it's fairly easy to, on the internet to find people that are into the same things, but it's really difficult to engage with those people in a meaningful way. And social media definitely does not give us the tools to do that. Everything is just so gamed right now. But yeah, when you're having discourse on social media, you're not even sure if it's for the right intentions of like exploring the topic or if it's just for that person to like raise their profile. So yeah, I think that like small group interaction is something that a lot of people are craving. But figuring out like how to make it useful as a service when you're not able to be there all the time to kind of like curate the quality, that's something that I'm really focused on trying to figure out at this point.
Well, very, very exciting. And that's something that like some of the questions that I've got for you, we can kind of play with community at like the sort of like meta level of like, if you were going to be designing, well, you are designing a community, but maybe if you were designing a platform for a community, like what are the things? And we were talking about this on our call yesterday about nouns and verbs. Mm-hmm. And wanted to kind of loop back around to the why of some of these things and kind of get your perspective on why certain understandings are so important for people that are making digital environments, making digital products, UX designers, whatever you want to call yourself, whatever role you're in, even product managers, product designers. So when it comes to like nouns and verbs, so nouns, concepts, objects, the things that make up a system. All right. Now, so many UX designers kind of traditionally will jump straight to the verbs. They'll jump to the interaction design. They'll jump to the flows, the task flows, the journey maps. Yeah. And there's not like in a lot of UX designers' process and a lot of like even like product design teams, there's not a whole lot of concentration, if any, on the nouns or the concepts. Yeah. Within the system, there's a lot, and the verbs are so important. Like you need to get stuff done within a system, of course.
Yeah.
But when we skip over the nouns, we can run into issues. So I'm curious from your perspective, like why is it important for people that are building digital products, especially complex digital products?
Yeah.
Why is it important for them to like really get clear collaboratively, even get on the same page on what are the things in this system?
I think I want to start by telling you a story about a startup that ate other startups. I worked with a video-based startup a few years back, and their main problem was that they had acquired other companies, and with those other companies came different nouns. And when you had all of a sudden 18, 19, 20 different ways to refer to some of these core things, based on all this proliferation across all of these different platforms that were all made by different teams, that was a very obvious problem. Like that was an emergency. That was get everybody in the boardroom for a week that's in charge of all of this stuff just to get on the same page that we have a language issue, that it's all the way through the front end, the back end, the middle tier, it's in everything all the way down. And now we have to make this massive change management initiative to change all of that, to streamline it. And it was very critical to them because they were about to translate their product into two other languages, which is, you know, spoiler alert, if you have duplicative nouns and now you're trying to translate them, all of that stuff's going to come up again. So
it's exponential,
I guess,
almost.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It grows. And so I think that like my word of warning to organizations and also individuals is that without an object-based understanding, there is a lot of duplication that can happen. And it's all based on human error. It's all based on our own mental models coming along with us into the work. And you know, what you call an article, I call a post. And the next thing you know, are we building one thing? Or are we building two things? I mean, that's like a very obvious example, but that happens all the time. And I think when I was consulting, which I don't anymore, but when I was consulting, it was very common for me to be the one that kind of had to like throw on the emergency brake and throw everybody on the train into this like state of panic that we had to fix this because it had gotten to the level where they had hired an external person to come and fix it. But there's so many opportunities in small teams within larger organizations that you can just have a lot more impact, a lot faster than you might think when you're tackling these object-based decisions. You can also go like way above your pay grade really easily, which is scary. In some cases, that's something that you need to do to like kind of get up there and be like, hey, this object level problem is going to affect everybody in the company for these reasons. But in other cases, you know, it can be a thing that is holding you back and you can't make a change on it. And now you're working around an object problem that is kind of cemented into an organization. So yeah, I just think that like the idea of object orientation in user experience is just incredibly critical to pretty much anyone, I would think. Yeah.
So I want to loop back to two things. So yeah. One, going above your pay grade.
I'm like, I need to turn my first. I'm like,
no, I'm silent. Am I on silent? I think I'm always on silent.
Okay. Yeah. It was one of those things where like I have do not disturb, but I actually have it because I have a kid. I have several people that can go through that gate.
Mm-hmm. And one of them decided to call me.
And I'm like, I really hope everything's fine, but it's not the preschool. It is not who has him. So let's keep talking.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. So going above your pay grade.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me more about what you mean. I think I know what you mean by that. But like, what does that look like when you're going above your pay grade with some of these object labeling language discussions mm-hmm. that can feel really scary? And maybe like even like what's the benefit of like pushing yourself a little bit to do some of that?
Sure. I think there's safe ways to do that. And then there's unsafe ways to do that. I think, you know, let's look back on that same story. So if we go down that path, let's ask ourselves a question. Do we think that I'm the first person that illustrated that problem in that organization? No, like none of us think that. None of us think that I'm a genius that came in and was like, well, what's your problem is that all these things mean the same thing and you guys need to fix that. Like, no, everyone in that organization knew different parts of that problem. And probably the people that knew the most about it was the help center. The call people, the people in the call center getting the calls from the users who were confused. And I remember for one object in particular, I think I mentioned that it's a video-based startup. The word was video. The object was video. And there were no less than 14 terms for how you might refer to a video in this product. And the help center had self-produced a guide for themselves on how to explain to customers the nuances between these incredibly related objects in everybody's ideas. So I feel like, yeah, that's kind of the trick of above your pay grade is like, was it somebody on the help center's job to raise that flag and say, hey, we're doing this a stupid way and we could be doing this better if y'all just got your act together on the product level. Yeah, sure. That could be something that the help center might have the opportunity to do at a certain point. But more likely, you get like a designer on that team and that designer starts asking questions to do something for the help center and they find out something like that. And then they might have the opportunity to then go up a few levels to highlight a problem. But there's safe and unsafe ways to do that. If you are a person who is constantly neglecting your low level assignment to go up above your pay grade to get strategic things done, but that is not your role, you're not necessarily going to be seen as a good performer. And I think that that's something that we all have to be really careful in advising people around of like understanding the culture of your organization and the appropriate reporting lines to kind of like manage. That's a part of working in capitalism. Like you decide to break through all that stuff and like, sure, you could be a rabble rouser, but like, yeah, I don't think that careers necessarily in-house are made that way. So I think people have to be careful about bringing in that sort of thing when it's related to the work that they're supposed to be doing, or at least not neglectful of the work that they're supposed to be doing, which, you know, in some cases it does get to that. It's like you get into that thing where the team wants to change the thing that's so big that they don't do the little thing that they've been asked to do.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, like that team might not last. And that's the reality of, capitalism, I suppose.
I got really good
advice. That was a dark direction for that question.
It sounds so true.
I feel like it's important. Like I used to think going above your pay grade was always a good idea. And that if you see something, say something. I don't think that's true anymore. I really don't. I think that there's, I think it's an unsafe thing for many people to do for many reasons.
I think so. I got really good advice early on in my career of do the job you have and also do the job you want, which is a little hustle culture in there.
Totally.
But this idea of like, yes, you've had like fulfill the responsibilities that you're given, and then you can maybe start pushing the envelope. And then how you push that boundary, it's like, do you take a baby step or do you like go, you know, like kind of like test the waters a little bit?
Yeah.
And then also like this idea of how you say something to, I found so much success in the positioning myself as a servant leader of like, okay, like, and even like, I mean, it sounds a little bit manipulative, but like making them think it's their idea by just asking questions like, okay, so is an article and a post the same thing?
Exactly.
Okay. It's the same thing. Wonderful. Like, do you think that maybe it would be better if we could just use the same word, and then having really good backup of the cognitive science behind it? Because basically, like, we're making people learn two words for the same, for the same concept. And that's going to add a little bit of cognitive load, and like the less cognitive load, the better. So like having like really good backup to like why you're saying things. So like with the labeling issue, like it can feel definitely above your pay grade, especially if you're saying, ooh, these are two different things. So like we were talking about community. So Mighty Networks is what we use in the for the OAUX forum. And there's articles and there's posts. And
oh my gosh, like I just pulled that one out and I didn't even know. Oh, that's
they are different things, and it makes no sense at all that they're different things, and there's different rules around them. The rules are hidden, there's different permissions around them. Changing something from a post to an article has issues, an article to a post has issues.
Yeah.
Those should probably just be one thing. Like the fact that they got turned into two things, and then they got kind of like stuck in that because now people have architected their entire networks around this concept of having posts and articles, and it created a whole lot of confusion. So that's another, like, it's maybe it's not even a labeling issue. It's literally a structural issue. Like these two things that have been different need to be merged together into just one concept because you're adding extraneous complexity to something. And that feels really scary. It's like, oh, we got it. That's big. That's bigger changes than just labeling changes. I mean,
it also, like, when something is stuck in the infrastructure like that, I feel like it's really important that we return back to the return on investment of changing it, because like there is the reality of change management and systems kicking back and not wanting to change. So like even a bad user experience, there will be pushback to change if people have gotten used to it in some way. We experienced that a ton at Etsy, where like sellers would just like, they hated what we had for something, and then we'd change it and they'd be like, but I actually knew how to use it before. So like I trained myself on it. So I feel like that's another thing about the sense-making role that I think is really critical to guide people on. And I find I cover this a lot in office hours of like, there's so much mess. And there's so many things that I could point to and say, well, that should be one thing, or that should work better, or that should be different. But when we're talking about tech debt, like when we're talking about understanding debt, I just feel like there's this level of perfectionism that we have to let go of at a certain point to actually get along in collaborative environments. Because if I go in as the IA and the sense maker on a project, and I just dig my heels in after discovery with like, these are all the things that are wrong, but I never go through the effort to really like let go of what can't be fixed and work with what I have, I'm always going to be a frustrated designer, and my team is always going to feel like I'm looking down on them and that I'm like not thinking that they're performing at a high enough quality. So I think that there's such a balance between like when you are of the sense-making persuasion, or you have become really attuned to those things, you see those problems a lot more obviously and a lot more clearly. But honestly, like the part that you're saying about cognitive load and like, shouldn't these both be the same? To me, those are the easy parts with other people. Like those are the parts where they're like, yeah, that would be great. Then I wouldn't have to do this. And I wouldn't have to have this document to explain to people on the phone the difference between these stupid things. Like, of course, it'd be great. But then you look at what would need to change to make that no longer the case. That is where people are in need of assistance in terms of coming along on the, why should you? And I think one of the things I've learned is that sometimes you shouldn't. Like sometimes you should leave the rabbit hole alone until it's an appropriate time, until it's rabbit season, let's say. Like it's not always rabbit season at an you can quote me. Like there's times where it's time to go down into those rabbit holes, but there's other times where doing so will likely affect your pay grade and not necessarily in a good way. I don't know. I hate to be like the devil's advocate on all of this, but that's the reality I've experienced.
In our advanced training, we had an advanced training last weekend. This is literally, I was saying the exact same thing of like, you can see understand that there's a rabbit hole there.
Yeah.
And maybe dip your little pinky toe in that rabbit hole just to see, do we need to go down that, maybe 15 minutes down that rabbit hole.
And the scope.
To see what's there. And then be like, just put a little scope down.
Yeah,
put a little scope down, look around and be like, that rabbit hole is for later. Or that rabbit hole, there's not going to be the ROI to actually go down that rabbit hole. Yeah. And so, I said to you recently, the people that a lot of OUXers are self-identified, or other people have identified them as overthinkers, which is usually often a beautiful thing. Often you're not over, often everybody else is underthinking it. And you've identified something that really needs to be untangled. But sometimes it's like, ooh, that's something. And it's that perfectionism coming through. Yeah. It's that ooh, that's really bad. We need to address it. And sometimes it's just not rabbit season. So
yeah, it's not rabbit season. I feel like the why is honestly the answer to that. Like if you can't tell me why, then you shouldn't do it. And if your why is because it's messy, you shouldn't do it. And I don't like messes. Like I don't want things to be messy. And you're hearing this from me. Like if the answer is we're doing it because it's too messy, what do you mean by too messy? Yeah. For who? In what ways? What are you using to measure that? What is your actual reality around that? That is incredibly difficult for many people to grok. It's like you dig into that space and they realize that a lot of the plan is based on their hunch, or a lot of their plan is based on one person's qualitative experience that's not even their user, or it's based on what a competitor has always done or what the company's always done. So I think that those assumptions, they're worth digging into. To your point, it's like just a toe. It's just a toe. Also on that point, this is something else that I'm more on the topic of diagrams, but I think it fits here. Once you have gone down that rabbit hole and you're like coming back up and doing your big, like, oh, this is what I found all down there, and this is my big messy map. Like, I think a lot of people think that that's the point where you like show people, that you like bring people and show them your big messy map. And that turns into such a mistake in collaboration most of the time, because now you're just showing them how far ahead you are on the understanding of this thing that they're just seeing for the first time. And so it's sort of like, I compare it to like, you know, those detective shows where they're always like that moment where you see like the dirty motel wall with like all the things and the pins and the string between the things. And it's like, you're not gonna walk the police chief in there and show him that. Like that would be concerning, and you might end up in the mental institution. But if you walk into the police station and you say, I know who did it, boom, done. You don't need to go through all of the hypotheses you had and all of the dark corners that you explored in every circumstance. Sometimes you do. Sometimes it's like you're getting the rest of your team up to speed and they really need to go through those messy maps. But I find in a lot of cases those things are used more as like proof that we did work than an ask for feedback or collaboration.
Right. And so what I'm usually encouraging is that collaboration bit. Like, let's all get into this mess together. Once we've identified the right mess to get into, often you need to bring your stakeholders into the mess, because what I hear so often is stakeholders like that, or PMs or whoever's like making the decision, making the timeline. They're like, oh, it's not that complicated. Like, just do it. And they don't understand the complexity of it. They don't understand some of the implications that they might be saying, like, oh, we just need to redesign these. Like, can you just UX these couple of screens right here? And, you know, sometimes you do need to bring the business folks into the weeds with you to like help them understand there's actually a little bit more to this, but just that balancing act, like always that balancing act of like, how deep do we go? Who needs to be in the room? Do we take them along with us? Or do we just like, you know, spend 6 hours going through the messiness and then somebody drops in and they're like, too much versus taking them through it. And there's just so much nuance to that. Other like little thing I want to loop back to is the, you know, like, do we fix it? Maybe it's not, maybe there, the ROI isn't there to fix that thing. Now, this is, you know, it could be, you know, too little, too late. That just, for some reason, I'm thinking of the saying, like, the best time to plant a tree is 30 years ago or today.
Sure. Yeah.
But if you are, if you are building something new, a new feature, a new product, okay, a new implementation of a product and a new platform or something like that, this is when to do the work. Like, take a little bit of an extra time so you don't create an article and a post that doesn't make sense to have both of them, so that you can come out the gate with a mental model, with a conceptual model that makes sense to the truth of the world, like how people think about these things, because it's so hard to go back from it. It's so hard to back up if you've created a conceptual model that people get used to, but doesn't quite make sense.
Right.
Ooh, stepping back from that is tough.
And I do, I feel like, because I know that so much of your audience is at the enterprise level, I'm like, I'm hearing the groans of like, but we're not starting new. We're not starting new things. But I want to highlight that there is a couple opportunities in those kinds of environments that are ripe for these kinds of conversations. One is acquisitions, and the other is the integration of partnership in software and SaaS. Like, if you are not assessing the object modeling of the SaaS product that you're about to have a multi-year contract with, you are losing a major opportunity, and you are maybe painting yourself into one of those corners where an article and a post are different. Because that's exactly where those things happen. Like with the video example, I love to use the kind of thought provoker of like, do you think that anyone could go into a room and come up with 14 ways to say video if they tried? I couldn't. I couldn't do it if I tried. Wouldn't be able to do it. If I assigned a creative team to do it and gave them a day, I don't think that they would be able to do it and for it to be not nonsense. But somehow this company did that. And I think that in a lot of cases, modeling is by barnacle, and it is kind of this like conglomeration of stuff that adds over time. And yeah, I see a lot of opportunity for like figuring out when is a good time to dry dock your ship and scrape all the barnacles off and figure out what's necessary. But yeah, I mean, if you're starting something new, I would hope that that's like really obvious insight, but I would also fear that it's the thing that everyone will skip because they're like, so much to do. So,
I mean, from working with startups, like usually it's that, you know, let's just move fast and break things. Let's just get something out there. Let's just get it out there. And then that just get it out there, that quick and dirty prototype then sort of becomes the foundation for all this additional work, instead of like, let's just take a breather, create that simple, to quote our friend, Dr. John Gall, create that simple system that works before we create the more complex system that works. Because if you create a simple system that doesn't quite work, and then you barnacle on top of that, then you're going to create a complex system that doesn't really work.
The stuff that nightmares are made of.
The stuff that our nightmares are made of, for sure. Okay, so let's talk about context. So context or relationships. So, and or like, so once you know the thing, let's say you get really clear on what those things are. We're building a new community. We've got people. We've got small groups. We've got topics. We've got articles, but not posts. We've got comments. We've got events, right? Like, we've got some of those core things, and we're like, yes, this is how people, when people think about community, not even within a digital implementation, when they think about community, that's kind of what they're thinking about, right? Now we need to start thinking about how those things sit in context, all right? Another thing that is often skipped, like, why is that important? Like, once you understand the things, to understand how they relate in a given domain or how they relate to the user, why is that something that we need to be concerning ourselves with?
I mean, I think that that's like, it's one of those things that adds towards or away from consistency. And I think that that's a major reason to pay attention to it. Like, if you are allowing all of the decisions about what things are to happen as things are being built, there's a high likelihood that they're not going to line up later on, and that they'll be more difficult to manipulate in ways that you want to. So they're more likely to get in the way of your intentions. So yeah, it feels like the relationship piece, generally, I think the reason that people struggle with thinking about it or even committing time to it is because it's so ephemeral. Like, it feels very much like when you're talking about relationships between objects, you're not necessarily talking about screens and you're not necessarily talking about flows. Sometimes you're talking about database structures. Hopefully you're talking about database structures, but it's like you're talking at this very conceptual level, even if you're talking about real things and real relationships between those real things. So I think that like taking those things out of people's heads is number one, like the most important thing. I can tell you that like even a simple set of relationships in one's head can feel really chaotic. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we can definitely do for our non-visual minded partners, is sort of like bring the visual and show them that like when it comes to relationships, that part really does, like looking at a list of objects is consumable for many. Looking at a list of relationships is not. So there's something about the diagrammatic part of that part of the process that is, it's a different kind of thinking. I think it's not as tactical. It can't be. So
I haven't really thought about like that level of abstraction that a relationship is. Like, I mean, I've tried, I know that explaining, like, I always joke that explaining cardinality is just like really hard. Like, can I just give you examples of different kinds of cardinality? Because like, giving you a definition, like the internet doesn't do it well either when you try to like get a definition of cardinality. But it's so important to really understand the cardinality of two things. Like, does a small group, how many people does a small group have in it? Like, what is small? Like, is it, you can't have just one person in a small group. Like, do you need 3 to 5 people? Is that how we define a small group? Or do we define a small group as 10 to 20 people? So figuring out that cardinality, or like, does an article have one comment? Like, if you designed a system with that cardinality of an article has one comment, then your system would be broken, because an article probably is going to need many comments on it. Right. Yeah. But it should also be able to have 0 comments. It should be able to have 1 comment. So so like, those are really, it's really tough to explain those things, and it is really abstract for people. And I think that's like a lot of what we, to give a little shout to the nested object matrix. So that's this diagram where we have our objects across the x-axis, the objects across the y-axis, and we just explore every single relationship in kind of a methodical way. So it is a list of relationships, actually. Yeah. And it is one of the hardest things for people to go through, but one of the most important things. And when it does click, it clicks. It will click eventually, but it is really tough for people. Another thing that I like to say about the importance of relationships is when you do have an object that's like kind of abstract. Mm-hmm. So something like even like a topic, maybe it could be a little bit more abstract, but like an enterprise, you know, like, oh my gosh, there's so many objects that are just like, what does that even mean? Or like just to switch over to finance, right? So like an object, like a future or an option, right? Like understanding that, so much is like, okay, if I can anchor that in something that people do understand, mm-hmm. like a company, right? So there's a company and there's transactions. Like, I understand a company, I understand transactions. That can help me understand the more abstract stuff. What's up, OUXers? There is something very important that I have neglected to do in the first 50 episodes of this podcast, and that is to implore you, dear listener, for a review. So here I am, asking ever so nicely for you to drop a rating and review of the OUX podcast into either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This can really help us spread the OUX love. So if you've gotten any value from OUX and the Orca process, which I'm assuming you have since you're here, I'd be so appreciative for a few minutes of your time. Okay, so how to do this? Don't actually go click on the rating metadata, because that would be way too intuitive. On Apple Podcasts, go to the podcast detail page, scroll to the bottom, and you'll see some big stars down there that you can add stars. And then underneath that, there is another little link that says create a review. So that would be amazing. And on Spotify, you've got to do this on the mobile. On Spotify mobile, go to the 3-dot menu on that detail page and hit rate. And actually on Spotify, even on an episode detail, you can leave a comment there too. If you scroll down on the episode detail, there'll be something that says something like, how did you like this episode? And feel free to put your thoughts there. Thank you so much and happy OUXing.
Yeah, there's so much education, I think, in this kind of sense making. Like you're going down in the rabbit holes and you're figuring out like the really nitty gritty detailed stuff, but then you're also coming back up to figure out what parts of that are important to document and for who and how many translations you have to put on that. Like I was working for Nike quite a number of years ago, and a big part of that project was educating designers at an agency on the digital sales process that Nike uses. And like, designers didn't know anything about selling sneakers wholesale, but they did by the end of the project because we all needed to. And one of the things that I marked as like the greatest accomplishment of that project for me was after a meeting, someone had assumed that I had worked at Nike for like 10 years based on the way that I spoke. And I was like, wow, like that's the power of language in terms of like, you started this whole line of questioning around context, but like, a word is not a word. A word is in context to where it's spoken, how it's displayed, or you know who it's coming from, who's hearing it. Like all of that really changes the nature of the word. And there's so many great examples of, you know, digital or not, of like words getting in the way of things. So yeah, words are hard.
Yeah, that I mean, honestly, like that those are some of my biggest wins too. Is leaving or like being within an Orca sprint, and on day two, they're like, "How much did you prepare for this?" And I'm like half a week or something. And they're like,
"Yeah,
what?
Just sponge it. Yeah.
How do you?" And it's by going to those nouns and how they all relate to each other, and basically building this map of like, this is what I do understand. This is the pieces that I don't understand. And being able to like with the Mormons. So I did some work with the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints, mm-hmm. and they have a very complex organization, like going into their organization and understanding like, what do they mean by mission? What mm-hmm. do they mean by church? Like it's actually different. Yeah. Than what we might think of in other denominations and other religions. Mm-hmm. So like actually having that understanding of churches and missions and elders and then like different flavors of mission, because there's like your mission and then there's the mission that happens within a geographical area. So like actually mission and geographical area were almost synonymous, and yeah. to be able to understand that and to ask questions around like, okay, what is the difference between a person's mission, right, that like has a start date and an end date versus the mission and like yeah. And, you know, they use all these words interchangeably, right? But to be able to come in and be like, ooh, I'm seeing the word mission used in two different contexts, meaning two different things, and yeah. to latch onto that and yeah. to be able to like have that kind of X-ray vision into like all the stuff that I was taking in, right? Yeah. Like just all like the website and like the vision documents that they've given me and like all this fodder to be like, ooh, here's a little thing that I need to ask a question on because I don't understand how this relates to other things within this particular context.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the mission thing is that it brings up so many examples for me of like, it's not always the thing that you came to fix, but it's the thing that's in the way of the thing you came to fix. Like I've had a lot of interactions with stakeholders that after, you know, oh, like there's two uses of the word mission or something similar. And they're like, yeah, okay. So like, yeah, that's fine. It's fine. So, but the problem becomes that they haven't yet understood how they're building scaffolding using those words. And that now they're building like skyscrapers on top of the scaffolding. And it's like, that's not safe. You shouldn't do that. You already know this is a problem. Like you should have a foundation, not scaffolding. Like this is, I think it's an important hindsight thing for a lot of folks to see so that they can have the foresight to not have it happen more. But that's the problem, is like when you learn that lesson, yeah, you're usually facing something that's a mess.
Right. Yeah.
It's usually like, your problem too when you notice.
And it's so funny because it's like, it can be fine colloquially, like to use those same words, like in conversation.
Sure.
Unless you're designing complex software and you're a professional designing complex software, when we're using the same word to mean lots of different things, or a different word, you know, lots of different words to mean the same thing. Like it's just going to be much, it's going to be hard for us to communicate with each other to get complicated shit done. And then it's also going to be really like, if we don't understand it, there's no way the users are going to understand it. Like,
right. I think this also, it's really important usually when talking about this part of IA to talk about, like, there are times when that's not going to happen. Like, either there isn't a potential for you to differentiate those things, or there's a really good reason for them to be different. Like, they are the same core objects, but they have different labels. And I think that that's a tactic that is often like the solve for the more advanced problem, is like, you are allowed to have different labels for an object across different audiences, but there are reasons why, efficiency wise or consistency of your tech stack or reporting, there's a lot of reasons why having the same object labeled differently can be more effective than having two objects labeled differently to do the same thing. And so I think, like, sometimes it's just like laying out the options of like, here's what we have now. We have two objects, two labels. We could go to one object, two labels, or we could go to one object, one label. Like, let's talk pro cons. What's the strategy for each? Because they can all be valid solutions to different problems.
So for an example, so another example I like to use a lot is with Delta. So we had, so there's flights and there's trips. There's also legs or segments. And it was literally, if I remember this correctly, Delta folks, don't yell at me if I'm remembering this wrong, but like, this
I'm a Delta girl, so I'm gonna call you up.
Oh, we love Delta. Delta, oh, seriously, I only fly Delta.
Oh, Delta.
We love Delta. Okay. But and this was actually building something new that had been before. It was literally travel agents emailing spreadsheets back and forth. So this is actually building new stuff. So we really wanted to get that mental model right out the gate. And so there was, in conversation, the term leg and segment was, I was like, are we using this interchangeably? Like, is this thing the same thing?
So
this is
fun. Like,
I think it is.
So fun.
It is so fun. Like, when you find these things too, it's just like a little gold nugget. It's like, ooh, okay, let's play. Yeah. And so they were like slightly different. And it was like, okay, so do we just merge? Do we just call it a segment? Or we call it a leg. Like, let's just pick a word. Let's just pick a word. Or are they nuanced enough to make them two separate things? And that becomes a really interesting design challenge, because when you have two things, and I want your perspective on this, like, when you have two things that are really close, they're very related, but they need to be different things. Showing that relationship between them really clearly and distinguishing them. So like, it almost becomes like, this is a really important design challenge. Like, we don't want to be wishy-washy about this, because we've at least identified that they could be potentially confused. So showing how they're different becomes something that we can do within actually the visual design, even showing them quite different, but still showing that they're like in the same category of things.
I think the acknowledgement of the potential question that a user might leave with, I think, is really powerful. I also think that, like, when you're looking at a problem like that, it comes back to like, how broad would we have to make the object so this was only a label and interface difference? Like, are these two things different enough all the way down to their core? Because, like, a good example is like, if you're customizing like a CMS or something like that, and you want to have like multiple pages where your posts or articles or whatever the heck they call them for that in different places on your site, you can use your tags to do that, right? And that's essentially saying like, things that are tagged this go on this page, things that are tagged that go on that page. And I feel like that's a really powerful organizational strategy that isn't used enough on core business objects. So like, for example, users, that's a huge one. Like, you'll see people create multiple types of the same person within a system where they're there as a user, and then they're there as a merchant, and then they're there as a commenter. And those are different systems that don't talk to one another. But I feel like there's places where, even when people say like, no, these are two different things, that like that next kind of toddler why needs to be brought out gently. Like, well, okay, trips and segments, like, or legs and segments. why are they different? Like, what are the differences between those things? And I don't know. They probably are in the way that that you landed, but I'm just thinking, like, there's so many times where I get to like the third why, and that's when I find out that they actually are very, very similar, but they're managed by two different groups of people, or they're very, very similar, but they're reported on in two different systems, or they're very, very similar, but one of them has an image and the other doesn't. And you're like, that's okay, right? Because now if we're designing for that object, we're just designing different instantiations of that object for different users in different contexts. So we're no longer like trying to figure out the relationship between those two objects because they're born of the same, like they have the same parent.
Right. So, right. Yeah. Yes. And like when you were talking about the user and like having, there's like the commenter user, and then there's the user user, and then there's the merchant user, like that, again, it's like the same thing, but almost we've created different things because of the different relationships. Like, oh, you're a merchant when you're in relationship with this store.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if you're in relationship to another store, you're a customer.
Exactly.
And if you're in relationship to this article, you're a commenter. But then if you're really, it's like, you're still just the same person. Like you're still a user.
Exactly. But now all of a sudden you're objects, you have all these objects that are people. And it's like, if you're not careful with really looking at that thoughtfully and contextually to your problem, you can kind of like bake yourself into some corners.
Yeah. I'll see when we're going through just object identification, like let's take like the community, there people will try to make user an object and friend an object.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
but then you have to tell them that friend is a verb and they're like, what?
Yes. Oh, and a relationship too. It's like a user has many friends who are also users. It's how you relate. It's all in context. Like, I'm only a friend. I'm a friend in context of you. Take somebody off the street, I'm not a friend in context of that person, but I'm still Sophia.
Yep. Oh my gosh. Yeah. There's so many systems that like I've seen where it's something as simple as they decided to tie the entire, you know, all of the things are tied to like email address or something like that, where, you know, it's an easy point of failure to identify if you're being thoughtful, but if you're just rushing to get something out the door, what's the easiest piece of information to get from somebody quickly to have a unique identifier? Email. Now you build a, I don't know, $1 billion business on it, decade and a half later, you're in a problem. You're in a security nightmare. You're in a governance nightmare. You're in a scaling nightmare.
Scaling.
Now you are making people make fake email addresses to open multiple instances of you. And this is a problem for many reasons. So yeah, yes. I've seen that problem in so many places, and it is born of not having, that basic object understanding.
Mm-hmm. Everybody look at your system. Everybody who's listening. And what is the difference between a user and an account?
Oh,
is there
God.
A relationship between the user and the account? Is it a one-to-one relationship? Is it a one-to-many relationship?
Yeah.
What does an account mean?
When people are like, where should I look for these things? I'm like, go to your settings. Like, it is in the settings. It is in the settings. It's all in the settings.
Everything is in the settings.
So much of the object modeling work is in the settings.
Oh my goodness. So I got one more question for you. So let's talk about diagramming. Your thing, okay. One of your things. So with diagramming, I love collaborative diagramming. It's a lot of what object mapping is all about. Let's all diagram together. Let's bring everybody in the room together. Mm-hmm. And I also love, and more, even though we have these kind of, we have lots of diagrams in the OUX world. We have our object map. We've got our Navflow. We've got our CTA matrix. And we teach them in a certain way. And more and more of what I'm doing with the advanced training and what I'm really trying to get across on this podcast and everything that I create is learn it and then bend it and break it, because you need to be able to think on your feet. This is like really what all the advanced training is all about, is like, how do you take this? And then in a certain context, like mash it up with something else, mix it up with something else. So wherever you want to go with this, but like collaborative diagramming, and also just like being able to diagram on your feet.
Yeah.
I know this is important to you, but like, why is this so important? That why is this such like a, I feel like this is a level up skill people, a facilitation skill. Why is this so important for people to be able to do this?
Oh, I think it's important because we all have diagrams stuck in our head. And, you know, some people are brave enough to get them out of their head. And some people are even brave enough to try to get the ones out of other people's heads. And that's where I think a lot of really good work gets done. Like when you can get that, I think it's funny. I always say, like, if somebody in the meeting is using their hands while describing some like gnarly thing, you probably have a diagram that's stuck in their brain and you need to get it out. And you can help them get it out, or you can try to get it out, you know, and for them and render it. But I think that until you have, it's really difficult to have a collaborative moment with that person, because we're all like sitting alone with our mental models, and we might be in the same room and we might even be sharing words. But if we don't have an object of that discourse, then we are much more likely to not be talking about the same things. We are much more likely to miss each other's points. We're much more likely to duplicate efforts and words. And so, yeah, I think diagramming is as simple as boxes and arrows. It is words. It's very cheap to make, but they're really difficult to get people to feel confident enough to sit down and do. And I think the reason is in researching the book, I came across a lot of like template dependency. Like they want to spend 15 hours on the internet to try to find the right diagram template for them to fill in with their problem to get to an answer. And that is almost never going to work. Like, I have had many times in my career where I have found myself doing those Google searches, and almost all of those times, what really was happening is I was afraid that I wasn't capable of solving that problem. And I was capable of it. I just needed to get over that fear point and rely on my tool set. And the tool set is not about templates. The tool set is about knowing contextually how to use these concepts and these methods in relation to what's actually happening on a given project. So it's the ability to have an entire workshop planned in a very specific way, but then have in the first 30 minutes some kind of ontological debate that breaks the framework entirely. And you still have to make all of that work. Like, that is still on you to get done. There's no like, oh, wait, let me just look up in the handbook what happens. Like, it's not a role-playing game. And I think that that's something that's really, yeah, it's hard to teach. It's mostly learned over time and in context to real work. And I think it needs constant reminders, because people tend to like seep into the perfectionism of like thinking that they have to fix all of the things and do all of the things. And those things are contrasting in my mind. So, yeah.
To me, it's also like, I mean, learning some of these methods, right? Like understanding like what a Venn diagram is. Like, okay, so I got these circles, and then I could put three circles in it. I could put, if I want, three circles, or I could, but then knowing what a matrix is. Yeah. And knowing what a flow diagram is, like, kind of like, yeah. So that then you can start mixing and mashing them up.
Sure.
So it's like having more paint colors, right? Like, if I have more paint colors, then I can like play with them more, and say like, ooh, I need something that's like part like Venn diagrammy thing, but it also has like a flow over to the side here. And I'm going to like layer on OAUX colors, and I'm going to put objects in blue, like, you know, being able to kind of take all that stuff and mash them up, and sort of like the more you have in your language of diagramming, but not being tied to those and not being thinking like, oh, like this is the job for, this is a Venn diagram and this is going to be a matrix. Like, yeah, might need to mash them up in some way.
I feel like that's one of the things I really tried to tackle in the book was showing examples and templates, but then also returning to first principles about what makes those templates work when they are working. Like, rather than, you know, knowing when to use a Venn, I think it's very powerful for people to think about what happens when you overlap things visually. Like, that is a very powerful method that you can then translate into a lot of different mediums, where, like, you know, putting a post-it note on top of another post-it note has a similar kind of a vibe of like, these things might be kind of similar. It's like, we all know that, well, we're going to put them near each other, you know, and they're not going to touch. They're just going to be near one another. And like, that is the same as the power of a Venn diagram, right? It's about the relationship of those objects and the closeness or the overlap of them. Same thing with flows. Like, if we're thinking about like, what's the power of flow? It's really directional. Like, it's the ability to have directional context and to have like logical changes of that flow. And so like learning that an arrow in a certain direction means something. I mean, I cannot tell you how obvious I find that and how mind-blowing that is for some people to learn. And that's also, I think, a really important thing for sense makers to acknowledge that, like, we're very attuned to these things and to these tools, and we've been trained in these tools for however long we've been practicing. Our partners have not necessarily. So when they're using an arrow to point to something in a diagram, we can't necessarily think that that's what that means, because they haven't necessarily given it the same thought to the first principles. And it might just be that, like, oh, that's the order that they drew the arrow on in PowerPoint. And so the arrowhead is on one side, not the other side. And to us, that's like, well, isn't it obvious that, like, you have to go in that direction for that flow to make sense? But for that person, they're like, no, I just wanted that thing to be connected to that thing, and I had an arrow, so I used it. So I feel like there's like teaching the building blocks of what these things are. And in Stuck, the second chapter is really about, like, breaking down the process of diagramming and going through shapes and lines and labels and key, and thinking about, like, what are those basics that then you can click together to make any number of these templates. And then further in the book, there's 12 recipes where you can sort of, like, identify what you're facing and then use a flow diagram to get to the right one, which is one of the things I'm most proud of in my career, I think, is that diagram itself.
I love the word recipe for this too. Like, that's what an object map is. Map is a recipe. Navlo is a recipe. Like, they're just recipes, and, like, they have ingredients, and you can play with those ingredients to make it right for you. So, I'm very excited to read Stuck with a bunch of OAUXers. And Marianne Bell, shout out to her. She's organizing the Books Club. Awesome. And maybe I'll have you back on the program.
I would love it
afterward, because we'll have so many more questions.
I would love it. Please. I would absolutely love that.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you so much for this conversation. This was super juicy. I mean, there's so many amazing nuggets here. Y'all, when people are talking with their hands, they got a diagram in there.
Stuck up there. Get it out.
That's so funny. They're just like,
you'll see it all the time in meetings now that I said it too. And it's like, it's an affliction. It's like bad menu design in restaurants. So it's like, once you've seen it and you know it's bad, you're going to see it all the time.
Yeah, but you see the opportunity there. Like, ooh, that person is trying to illustrate something, and I can help them do that probably. Beautiful. Abby, thank you so, so much for being here. We will put the links to all the things in the show notes, all the stuff that you're working on, and just really excited for your community launching soon this year.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OAUXing!